The Making Of is sponsored by Missoma.
Every piece of a woman's jewellery tells part of her story. Earrings she bought with her first paycheck, a pick-me-up present from her best friend after a crappy breakup, the matching bracelets they got on that wild holiday, her 18th birthday, her 30th birthday, an anniversary gift she'll never forget. From past loves to career milestones, from morning to night, we wear our treasured moments, whatever shape or size. And Missoma is here for all those moments. They're on a mission to build a more confident, creative and collaborative world, starting a chain reaction, one link at a time. Make your moments last forever with Missoma and get an exclusive 15% by using MAKE15 now on Missoma.com.
Welcome to The Making Of, a podcast from the female lead. I'm Bea Appleby, and in this series, I'll be talking to some of my favourite women about the moments that have made them. The highs, the lows, the life lessons, but I promise we won't call them journeys. My guest today is the actor Rebecca Root.
The acting profession is one of the hardest professions there is, and nothing really prepared me for that. Mm. And as well as struggling with finding a foothold in the industry, I was still struggling with my gender identity.
Rebecca came to fame in 2015, starring in the groundbreaking BBC TV series Boy Meets Girl, where she was the first transgender actor to be cast in a lead transgender role in a mainstream sitcom. Since then, Rebecca has worked on a range of film and TV shows, including the smash hit The Queen's Gambit and The Danish Girl. We talked about the huge changes in her life, the power of an inspiring teacher, struggling with gender identity and falling in love. So, here we go. Rebecca Root, welcome to the Female Lead Podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
So today we're going to talk about six moments that made you. Let's get into it. Let's get right into it, Rebecca.
Okay.
So let's start with moment one. This is doing the school nativity play, age five.
I think I played as one of the wise men. Unfortunately, I just remember thinking, well, it just seemed so unfair that I couldn't be Mary, because that was the, you know, obviously the star female part.
This moment you describe as a kind of dual epiphany where you realised, A, you loved acting and B, or being on stage, and also that you would really rather have been the Mary part.
Yeah. Yeah, it's an interesting thing, really. I mean, people often ask me, when did I feel that I was born differently or wrong or whatever? And I suppose that's, you know, the age of 4 or 5. I mean, earliest memories, and those earliest memories coincide with the knowledge that I wanted to perform. So I you know, in my memories, they exist in the same place, really, because they're both such strong identities that I can't really separate them. We can't always understand them, those identities, and we don't necessarily have the vocabulary to express what it is that we need. But we are young when we start to understand something about ourselves.
And before that moment, I mean, these are very, very early memories anyway. Do you remember having any feelings about your gender or an understanding of it? Or
No, not really. No, I suppose, I mean, I recognised that I had a different anatomy to my older sister. And I'm always a bit reluctant to imbue a memory with the sort of an adult perspective,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah, totally.
So it's difficult to sort of pinpoint, really.
So from that nativity play onwards, were you then kind of looking for any opportunity to perform?
I did all the school plays. I loved the school plays. There was another school play we did. I still remember it. It was called Spider Monkey Uncle King. And it was a sort of a play with songs. The main plot was that the prince had to flee this despotic household, and the cook helped the prince escape. And I was originally cast as the despotic king, but I was most disappointed because the cook's method of escape was to disguise himself and the prince as females.
Ah.
And the little boy whose who'd been granted the part of the cook, didn't want to dress up as a girl. So I said, well, look, why don't we swap places, swap parts? I'll play the cook and you can play the king. And the teacher said, okay, if you don't want to, you know, it's fine. In my head, of course, I was like, great, you know, that means that I get to wear a dress again.
Right.
Moving on from the wise man's robe.
Right.
It was a bit of a treat, really, to sort of put on this dress.
Yeah.
And you know, in the context of the play, there's something about dressing up that is innate in a lot of young people. You know, I know that when I was growing up, I wanted to dress up in my mum's shoes and lipstick and my sister's clothes and so on. Just something about feeling at home in those mm-hmm. clothes. And so that play that we did was gave mm-hmm. me a wonderful opportunity to exist in both worlds, you know.
Yeah,
I'd forgotten about that until we started speaking about it. So it's funny, isn't it?
At that time, were you talking to anyone about those thoughts, or was it just something that you just kept to yourself completely?
No, kept them to myself. And you know, when I was caught at home trying on my sister's dress or something, I mean, my mum said, bless my mum, you know, but she said, no, that's not really what little boys do. So it wasn't encouraged. I mean, my parents weren't monsters, and they didn't sort of, you know, lock me away in a darkened room as a punishment for wearing those clothes. But they just said, look, you know, it's not really the thing. So so I understood that in the 70s. I mean, even at that age, there was no vocabulary or you know, there's no role model or nobody to talk to about it, and as a child you don't really understand that anyway. So I just suppressed it all, and obviously if an opportunity arose where I could wear a dress, like in the play,
yeah,
then great. You no
did.
One's going to stop me then, are they?
Right.
Because it's written down in the play. But yeah, growing up as an adolescent, that was pretty difficult. Yeah.
Well, let's go to moment number two, which is moving to the Cotswolds, age 11. So you moved from Surrey to the Cotswolds, and you say that you stuck out like a sore thumb and you felt very different there. What was the difference?
Well, my voice, I think, principally. You know, my parents encouraged me in my acting hobbies, and as well as the school plays, I used to do sort of Saturday morning drama club, and mum and dad also gave me or sent me to elocution lessons, remember those, you know, and doing sort of Lambda speech and drama exams and all of that, all that entails. I left Surrey at the age of 11 or 12, whatever it was, with a terribly sort of what we would now consider to be quite a posh voice.
Posh.
We lived in a small village. My accent, I feel, did me no favours, if I'm honest with you. I was lonely, I was missing my friends, and I didn't know, I wasn't very well, I wasn't particularly good at making friends, you know, and then that kind of combined with adolescence and growing up all wrong.
Yeah, it sounds like a lonely time.
Yeah, it was, yeah.
Yeah. You had this teacher, Mr. Grossman.
Grossman. Yeah. So Mr. Grossman encouraged me in the acting. He saw my potential and he nurtured it. And he coached me on my audition speeches and got me into, first of all, the National Youth Theatre. And then he coached me on my audition speeches for drama school. And I finally got into drama school. So I owe him an enormous debt, but I don't know how to reach him, whether he's still alive even. So if he ever listens to this, then you know, thank you, Mr. Grossman. And then the English teachers and a couple of French teachers were more the sort of people that I would perhaps turn to, because this is an age before school counsellors, or I was still wrestling with my nascent gender dysphoria. I would sometimes try to sort of talk about that with some of the other sympathetic teachers.
And in those days, what was their What kind of things were they saying to you in response?
It was like the vocabulary and the my understanding of my gender identity. I wasn't sure exactly what it was.
Mm.
I didn't know if it was just a thing about clothes, or I didn't know if that was something that I felt was I was trans per se and wanting to transition. Mm. I didn't know whether I could live a life where I could be female, quote, at the weekends, you know, for want of a better term. So I think people's general kind of understanding in the 70s and 80s was that it was maybe a phase and there was nothing to be ashamed of. Lots of people explored their gender or their sexual identity. And
I suppose around that time, there were things happening, weren't there? I mean, this is like late 70s, early 80s. So there's sort of David Bowie, you know, Neuromantics kind of glam rock, which I guess is like an opening up of some ideas of how you can dress and act. And I don't know, did that have any impact on you?
I celebrated and was, you know, envious of the ease with which Bowie and Boy George, the ease with which they could manifest this spirit of otherness. We can't necessarily conflate otherness with transness.
No.
And I don't know whether any of those people were specifically trans or innately trans. They were just celebrating maybe the performativity of otherness. And it is a kind of a bit of an overlapping blurred area where performativity and gender expression undercuts transness or the other way around. I admired those performers, but that didn't necessarily mean that I wished to emulate them.
Right.
Because they were expressing something different.
Different, yes, yes.
In terms of visibility of transness in those days, in the 80s, you know, you had the sort of the drag, Les Dawson, Dick Emery, the two Ronnies doing effectively drag in their sketches. And there wasn't really anybody that I could find who could be a recognisable beacon of transness. I mean, there was Caroline Cossey, but she was famously a Bond girl. And I think she did some glamour modelling. Mm-hmm. And she is still, but she was, as a young woman, you know, a beauty to aspire to. And the fact that she was trans was she showed the world that you could transition and be successful.
And at that point in the sort of teenage years, like you say, you weren't entirely sure what you wanted, or were you coming to a point where you knew, like, actually if I could transition, that is what I would really want?
I think that's, yes, I knew that's kind of what I wanted, but I saw no way of achieving that. And so it really just became, it was nothing more than a pipe dream, really. And it took a very long time for me to work through, you know, an understanding and an acceptance of my gender identity, and of sort of finding that healthcare provision could catch up with that, or that I caught up with that.
And so you went to drama school, and then moment three is after drama school. You talk about graduating from drama school and discovering how challenging the acting profession actually was.
You know, drama school, I began to understand myself and what I could be more and more clearly.
Right.
What was challenging when I left drama school was really seeing in sort of without the rose-tinted glasses that the acting profession is one of the hardest professions there is, and nothing really prepared me for that. And as well as struggling with finding a foothold in the industry, I was still struggling with my gender identity. And by now we're in the 90s, and there's greater visibility of transness and trans people, but again, there are no real parts to speak of. And I knew that what little career I was building was solely possible for male parts.
And were you at that point talking to friends? I'm guessing, I don't know for sure, it would have been an environment where people were probably a bit more open-minded and you could talk about things like that. And were you having relationships, like romantic relationships, Was that happening?
Yes,
to you?
Yeah, I had some girlfriends and some dalliances. Mm-hmm. I suppose I was still exploring my sexuality as much as my gender identity. I had a relationship with a woman who is now one of my closest friends. Mm. We were together for several years, but you know, ultimately, it was not to be, because I was in the wrong body.
Yeah.
And, that was proving to be a very difficult stumbling block in the right. relationship.
What you've been kind of putting to one side as a pipe dream, was it just like constantly coming up as, you know, transitioning as something that you were seeing maybe as more of a reality, or just seemed more urgent to you? How was this?
Yes, I mean, it became apparent that I couldn't exist in that state. I tried to suppress it. I tried to sort of have this part-time existence where I could present as female occasionally, but it was exhausting.
Right.
And felt like I was leading a double life. I was leading a lie. And that was affecting, obviously, it was affecting me and my mental health, but it was also affecting my work, really, because I felt like I was not being able to be the actor who I needed and wanted to be. And I felt if I couldn't be authentic and truthful in my own self, how could I possibly hope to be truthful and authentic playing another character? So I really felt that I had to make a decision between my, well, transitioning or my sanity or my life, really.
And for anyone who, you know, who doesn't fully understand what that can be like, as you just said, you have a vocation to be an actor, and by transitioning, potentially, you could be reducing the parts that you can get. You know, you didn't know what it would do for your career. You thought, in fact, potentially it could be bad for your career, but it was just, you could not go on as you were, even at the expense of this vocation that you had. I hope you're enjoying the podcast so far. I just want to take a minute to tell you a bit more about The Female Lead. We're a charity founded by Edwina Dunn, exploring the factors that limit women's success and fulfillment. By listening to women and understanding them through research and data, we aim to influence businesses and government to drive real change. We're passionate about telling women's stories, and that's what this podcast is all about. So please do rate and subscribe at the end. It will really help us to continue our work and tell more women's stories. So moment four was deciding in 2003 to take the step to transition, which is just a huge moment, obviously.
I split up with my partner with whom I'd had that long relationship, five or 6 years, and that was in the sort of the mid to late 90s. I think in 98 I brought it up seriously with my GP, who referred me to sort of local, you know, the sort of psychiatric care. And it was a long process of waiting lists and evaluations and talking to people, and then more waiting lists and more talking and more different consultants, and then finally getting to Charing Cross, where the UK sort of principal gender identity clinic is located. And so it was a slow process, and I don't regret that, actually. I think that sometimes in life we make decisions and take years to enact them. And to act on those decisions. I don't regret that delay, because it was part of the thing that made me and built me. And I know that there are instances of trans people who make snap decisions and they transition and later apparently reportedly regret that. And other people who don't. I mean, the world is full of different people. We all have different experiences of being trans.
Yes.
But for me, it was a better scenario that I took it step by step by step, because it's a big deal.
And I read recently the great piece that you wrote in the Times. You were saying that you are so lucky in that you have had the support from parents and friends that has helped the whole process for you. After you made the decision and then after you started the process, what was that like?
I was working in a rent job at the Royal Opera House in the box office, and they'd never had a trans person on the payroll before, and they were enormously supportive, actually. I kind of, in a way, I transitioned a bit back to front because I made my sort of big announcement to the world that I was changing my name and this is why and this is mm-hmm. what had been going on with my doctors and everything for some years. But I made all of that announcement before I actually had undergone any facial hair removal. And I used to have quite dark, strong facial hair. I had been on a low hormone dosage, which had started to kind of develop my bust, and I softened my skin, but the facial hair was very visible. Mm. So what a lot of trans people will do is that they will start that process of hair removal before they make their announcement, so that when they make their announcement, they look relatively smooth mm-hmm. skinned. Which unfortunately is a rather big reveal for a trans person. I did therefore have some difficulties in my transition because I still had aspects of, shall we say, masculinity mm-hmm. or maleness, which was difficult for some people to correlate to somebody who was calling themselves Rebecca. And brought my driver's license or my passport out, if I got challenged in a shop or whatever, I said, well, here's my passport, it says Rebecca, there's the F for female, and they kind of got the picture and then, you know, let me use the loo or something like that. But in a way, I look at some of the sort of the trans warriors that we see today who either, you know, they're non-binary or gender non-conforming, or they inhabit somewhere, a space between male and female, and they don't give two hoots about what they look like or what people think of them. And in a way, maybe I was ahead of my time. And because I just, you know, I just went for it, you know. So, you know, it's 17 years ago. Wow. I transitioned. I know. It's amazing, isn't it?
That's a long time. And after you'd made the decision, after you started the process, was there any point when you thought, what is this? What have I done? Or did you always just think, once you've done it, this is it. I'm glad I've done it. I'm glad I've made this decision. I'm going for it. Or were there any times where you thought, this is too hard?
Well, certainly in the early days of transition, yes, that was... I never in all the years, never have I regretted it, transitioning. It was definitely not just the best thing I could ever have done, but it was the only thing I could ever have done. Mm. I don't think I'd be having this conversation with you. I wouldn't be having a conversation with anybody if right. I hadn't transitioned. I don't think I'd have made it, if I'm honest with you. Mm. I'd either have killed myself or I'd have drunk myself into an early grave or I just don't think I would be here. You know, that week, that I transitioned, you know, I changed my name. I won £100 on a scratch card, which I'd never done before. And I got a job on casualty. However, completely isolated as a trans person, commencing her transition in a very public way, you know, the sort of the influx of hormones, I was teary. I would go out for my evening meal and I'd just sit there and I'd be crying into my dinner. And, you know, I felt really isolated and lonely. But picked myself up, dusted myself down, got on with a job.
So around that time, what was it like getting work?
Few and far between. I mean, I just, I didn't really do any acting per se for some years, and then I was at the box office still in the Opera House. But after a couple of years, having navigated transition and being, you know, settling in and settling into life, and I figured there has to be more to life than this. If I'm not going to be acting, then what do I do? So right. I decided to do my MA,
which is moment five, doing your MA in voice studies.
I did the course, I did well, and my focus on that course was the trans voice. And my thesis was published, and then I started doing workshops based on my thesis, and I did that internationally, and all of a sudden became a much more successful voice teacher than I'd ever been as an actor.
Right.
And I was going all over the place, and I was working at a number of drama schools, and I was also coaching private clients, trans clients, as well as some business people.
Mm.
And I suddenly had this enormously rewarding career as a voice teacher. You know, I didn't give up acting.
Mm.
But by and large, that was my thing. And I was okay with that. It was incredibly rewarding, that time of my life.
And then we come on to Boy Meets Girl, which is moment 6, which is really an enormous turning point for you, isn't it? So this is the part that you got in Boy Meets Girl 2015, and which brought you onto, you know, prime time mainstream TV. How did you get that part? How did it happen? What's the process?
I owe so much to that job. It's opened so many doors. I think in 2012, 2013, there was a script competition hosted by the BBC and the Trans Comedy Award to seek scripts for sitcoms that featured a leading trans character in a positive light. The script competition prize was a sum of money, but also a table read in front of an invited audience of industry professionals. And that script was, I auditioned for the winning script at the table read. I had a message from the production company saying that the BBC has commissioned a pilot, which we filmed in 2014, in the sort of February or something of 2014. The BBC commissioned a full series. And it changed my life. It meant that I had to step away from a lot of my teaching commitments. I've been very lucky in the last few years.
Yeah, after that, there were, you know, all kinds of other things. You just did Last Christmas as well. And then you're the first, I mean, it's not on TV, but you're the first Doctor Who companion who is transgender, which is an amazing, you know, piece of history. And of course, there's the Danish Girl as well. I mean, that really was just opened up a door into...
Exactly, a whole new phase. And, it, you know, not only was it interesting to be part of that increased visibility as a trans person, but also as a 45-year-old woman, which I think is in itself pretty impressive. So I think we were making strides on all sorts of levels with that show.
The other thing that you told me about is that Boy Meets Girl was where you met your partner, B.
It was about my increased visibility.
Ah, I see.
And she didn't work on the show, but she saw the show. We met at a theatre where I was in the audience. I was attending a show and she was working front of house. And she said, she tore my ticket and she said, I hope you don't mind my saying, but I saw, and as she was saying this, I thought she was going to say Boy Meets Girl. B said, I saw you in Transcripts in Edinburgh last year. And I was like, oh, wow, did you? Because it was in a tiny venue and it was on the fringe. And although it had been very well received, you know, the audiences were obviously much smaller. But then she surprised me with that. And we just fell into conversation. And then after the show, we had another little chat. And then we found each other on social media. And, you know, the rest is history.
The rest is history. And you've been together now since around then?
Yeah, 4 years, yeah.
Just smiling.
I know. Well, she makes me smile. I only have to think about her and she makes me smile. You know, she makes me happy.
She's got a great name.
Yes, exactly. Although she spells it slightly differently. It's, yeah, we are B&B because my diminutive is Bex.
Bex. B&B, well, that's just so cute.
Yeah. We're thinking of calling our flat here the Beehive.
Oh, I love it. Very, very nice.
I think I am lucky. I'm one of the lucky ones, you know.
Well, when you talk about, you know, the point at which you were saying to me, I couldn't have continued as I was if I hadn't transitioned. I don't imagine at that point you would have seen this future being so great.
No.
As it has turned out to be.
At the time of my transition, I was just glad to be alive and glad to have the energy and strength and the support of family and friends to navigate that transition.
Okay, so this is sort of a nice final question for you. So talking about moments, when you need to think of a happy moment, like you're trying to get to sleep or you just need to, you know, go to a happy place, what is the moment that you think of?
Well, at the moment, I can't think of anywhere happier than being with Bea on the beach here in St. Leonard's and just looking out at the sunset and having a cold beer and just sort of hearing the sound of the sea.
That's lovely.
And that's the end. I hope you had a good time. Thank you for listening. If you've enjoyed this, please do rate and subscribe. We'll be back next week with another brilliant woman's story. If you want to know more about the female lead, please check out our website at thefemalelead.com or our Instagram or our Twitter or Facebook or TikTok or LinkedIn. You name it, we're there for you. See you next time.